We're going to learn about some more early pro football teams going from the early days of pro football in the late 1800s in Pittsburgh all the way to the Massillon Tigers with Greg Fisseri and his great-grandfather's story, Bob Schiering, on the Massillon Tigers, coming up in just a moment.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at SportsHistoryNetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com, and welcome back to the Pigpen. We have another great show today. We are Monday, and we are talking about the early pro football teams, you know, some of them before the NFL, and today, in fact, it is before the NFL. You know, when you think about those early pro teams, you may think of like the Canton Bulldogs. Well, probably their biggest rival is just a few miles, not very far, to the west of Canton, and that is Massillon. And the Massillon Tigers were a great early pro football team. And today we have an expert on the Massillon Tigers, Greg Fisseri. I'm going to bring him in right now. Greg Fisseri, welcome to the Pigpen.
Great to be with you tonight, Darren.
Greg, maybe if you could just tell us a little bit about yourself and, you know, maybe what part of the world you're in and what got you interested in football.
So I grew up in Pittsburgh, a little suburb about 5-10 miles east of Pittsburgh called Churchill. And my grandmother lived in a older industrial suburb called Wilmerding. And I grew up knowing that her father, my great-grandfather, Bob Schiering, was an early pro football great for the Massillon Tigers. And she had some really special oversized frame photographs on the wall of her basement that were like larger than life to me and captivated my interest from my earliest days. And I just had some family lore to go with it a little bit, something about a gambling scandal that he was caught up in 1906. He was, somebody attempted to bribe him as to fix the outcome of championship games between Massillon and Canton, and that he didn't do it, wouldn't participate. And he was honored for his integrity for that. And I always wanted to know more. And as the internet came around and I was able to dig into this story more, I learned some amazing things that have led me to write a book that we're going to talk about that's about to be released hopefully by the end of the year.
Well, hey, why don't we give the title of that book? We can get some folks interested into it, and then we'll give them some maybe an address or something, an email address they can pre-order or order, whatever you
sure,
like near the end.
Sure, thanks. Okay. Yes. The book is called Gridiron Legacy, subtitled Pro Football's Missing Origin Story. And the website is gridironlegacy.com. And the book can be pre-ordered right now and get a signed copy. And as I said, we're working as fast as we can to get it delivered. I'm not sure what's going on quite yet with all the supply chain issues with COVID and everything, but we're working diligently.
Wow. To paraphrase the movie, Jerry Maguire, you had us at Gridiron Legacy. You know, that's what we're all about here. So this is exciting. But we're going to get to talk tonight. We have you on to talk, a little bit about the book, but really about the Massillon Tigers, the team that your grandfather played for. And maybe if you could, maybe get us, take us back to the beginning of the Massillon Tigers.
Sure. So if I could, I'll take you even back just a little further to the beginning of pro football, which was in Pittsburgh, actually, in 1892. Some real pro football historians might know the name Pudge Heffelfinger and how he, the Hall of Fame in the 60s, discovered that the birth certificate of pro football that this All-American from Yale signed to play for the Allegheny Athletic Association back then. And then so 10 years of football went on and pro football went on in Pittsburgh until 1902. And my great grandfather, turns out, started playing for a team, a top amateur team around 1899 called the Lallis Athletic Club. He ended up being recruited to join the Homestead Library and Athletic Club team, which won sort of the world championship, if you will, in 1900 and 1901. And in 1901, they beat a team from Philadelphia that joined the mix, led by a fascinating character named Blondie Wallace, who was an All-American at Penn. The teams in Pittsburgh kept sort of failing financially, merging. 1902 was the last year there. And another team called the Pittsburgh Pros that my great-grandfather played on beat Wallace's team again and from Philadelphia for the world championship. And but that was the end in Pittsburgh that year. And so that's when Maslin got the idea, and really the leader of that effort was another fascinating character named Edward Stewart, or E.J. Stewart. And he wore all these hats in Maslin. He was the quarterback of their amateur Maslin Tigers team. He was also the sports editor for the Maslin Gleaner. And he was a city clerk, sort of a mid-level politician there. So a very ambitious fellow. And he pitched the idea to a lot of the Maslin industrialists and business leaders to bring my great-grandfather and three of his teammates from the Homestead team to Maslin to help them.
Greg, could I pause just a second?
Sure.
Could you, what, I'm not sure if you said it or not, but what was your grandfather's name?
Yeah, Bob Shiring.
Bob Shiring. Okay, no problem. That. You might have said it. I don't think
I did.
Okay, thank you.
So Bob Shiring and three of his teammates agreed to join the Maslin Tigers in 1903, and right at the end of the season. And it was murky to the local public whether they were who they were and if they were professional. And you know, there's a lot of criticism about them sort of bringing in these four ringers. And they ended up beating Akron in a tight game. I believe it was 6-5 in the state championship game of 1903. And so in the following season, other teams started to see how this was going, and they started to bring in other pros. And Canton sort of sat on the sideline until 1905, I believe, if I'm getting my facts straight. But that's when they went to get Blondie Wallace from Philadelphia and sort of bring the Pittsburgh-Philly rivalry to Maslin and Canton. And it all went really, you know, great for at the beginning, getting a lot of national attention, and for these the greatest players in the country coming to play in this rivalry. And sadly, in 1906, it all ended sort of infamously in a gambling, alleged gambling scandal. So that scandal hung in mystery forever since then, which was really kind of a cold case that captivated my interest. And I wanted to solve it if I could, since I realized I couldn't find, you know, a solution or to what happened.
So a little bit of a football forensics on your part.
I had little clues in newspapers about lawyers' names and judges' names. And it seemed like there was a trial that was supposed to happen. The Maslin paper, led by E.J. Stewart, accused Wallace of colluding in this scheme, in this scam. And he denied it. Others supported him. And he sued a number of parties, the Maslin team ownership, the newspaper, E.J. Stewart himself, for libel, but never had his day in court. So magically, I discovered the court file. And it's really the heart of the story. It's an incredible story.
Wow. You definitely have whet our appetite for your book. And you said that's hopefully coming out in the next month or so. So very interesting.
We're just wrapping up some editing and layout and design. It's actually a beautifully illustrated book as well. I have photo collection of my great-grandfather Shiring that the Hall of Fame really thrilled about. They call it like finding a constitution to them. They didn't have any of these images from the pre-NFL era. So they really encouraged me about 10 years ago to try to do a book. When I couldn't find anybody to write it for me, I eventually found a publisher that told me they would only do it if I wrote it myself, because I had the passion for it. So I was like, oh boy, I got a lot of work ahead. But
I'm certainly glad that they did, because that's best when it comes as close to the source as it can, and somebody's got the fire like you do, and you have the family ties to it. That just brings that much more passion brings a better story. So
that was what they said. They wanted to hear my voice in it. So my voice got a little more confident along the way. And I think it's pretty good and a very beautiful, beautifully illustrated book that people will enjoy. And sort of I think the images animate the story and bring it to life more. You can put faces with names and imagine who these people are and what they look like. I think that's part of what makes it pretty special.
Wow, that definitely sounds like a great piece. Seeing, not only reading the text of it, but seeing these great pictures that no one else has seen except for you and a few choice others. That sounds great, because that's great football history. Okay, so they had the scandal, and from what I understand, the franchise sort of stopped playing for a little bit.
Yeah, so there was, as a professional model, after 1906, it died. At least in the Ohio League. It really, the term Ohio League, it turns out, really wasn't used at that time. It sort of came to be known as that later. It was just sort of called the Ohio State Championship. They sort of went back to a semi-pro model. They might have paid a couple guys to play, but had more local players for a few years, and they slowly kind of had to heal from that situation. The public lost a lot of faith in, pro football, but eventually it came back around. Around 1912, there was a character named Jack Cusack, who was a 16-year-old kid in 1906 and just a Canton Bulldogs fan. And there was a great story. He wrote a book called Pioneers in Pro Football, I believe, a very short book, just about his recollections and his involvement in the game. But he said he went, an older gentleman took him to the Cortland Hotel bar in Canton, Ohio, the night after the infamous second game in 1906 between Canton and Massillon. And this bar fight broke out when the guy that took him there stood up and yelled out that he thought the games were fixed. And some of the Canton players were in there and, said, no, they weren't. And they started brawling, and literally, like in a Burt Reynolds movie, somebody went through the glass window. And Cusack's line was, it was right then I knew this sport was for me. So 6 years later, he's 22 years old. And somebody asked him, he took on a volunteer role as, from his professional job at a company to on the side to work with, the new Canton Bulldogs. And it was actually his idea to help recruit Jim Thorpe again to bring pro football back into popularity. And so they recruited Thorpe after the 1912 Olympics, and he won the decathlon and pentathlon, world's greatest athlete. And when Thorpe came back, it did reinvigorate interest in pro football. And so it went on from there. And eventually, the Massillon Tigers started up again, too, and recruited Newt Rockne in 1915, I believe. And when Rockne and Thorpe played against each other, Massillon won again. But a few years later, of course, we know the NFL, or at least it was called the APFA, or American Pro Football Association, had their meeting in Canton in 1920 at the Ralph Hayes Hupmobile. And that is ultimately the answer to why the Hall of Fame is in Canton, that the NFL was founded there, not because pro football started there.
Basically, the inaugural meeting of the NFL, which was the APFA at the time. So, but you really have a lot of great football there in that early APFA. The Akron Pros, not too far away from that area. They won the first title, Canton, Massillon, Cleveland got into the mix a little later on. Really a hotbed of football is right there. So it sort of shifted from Pennsylvania, like you said earlier, at the turn of the century, a decade and a half later, we have Ohio that's the breeding ground for pro football. Very interesting. Yeah.
Briefly, I just started, recently wrote the sort of close to the book, and which is, about how the NFL or APFA got started there and the teams that were involved. It turned out Maslin didn't join the APFA. Some people knew that they had the potential to be in it, and one guy even wanted to create a traveling team and just with the name Maslin Tigers because it was marketable. They could do well on the road, but there wasn't really enough interest in Maslin to keep the pro team going or be a part of that. So I believe it was Ralph Hay himself blocked that guy from doing that and sort of represented the Tigers in that meeting at the Hutmobile dealership, but only for the sake of saying Maslin has declined to join. So that he wanted to preserve their, you know, name and pride and tradition without allowing somebody to sort of take advantage of it.
Now, what was the reasons for the real Maslin team not to join the APFA?
Not terribly, you know, clear about the details, but from what I read recently, I believe there just wasn't enough interest or belief that they could make it successful in Maslin and at that scale. Yeah. It's a very small town, and you know, they've always lost money before pretty much. So the 10 teams that were in attendance at the meeting, maybe I think 14 teams initially comprised the APFA. They started being from out of state and as well. And so it was a financial experiment. And I think Maslin had kind of had its fill at that point.
Yeah, you figure it's got to be expensive, especially when you have, you know, teams up in Buffalo and Rochester, and just the train fare to put, you know, 20 some odd guys on a train to get them up there to play, and food and lodging. You know, you got to feed these big guys to play ball for you. So I'm sure that would be a great expense. So I can see why somebody would not be able to field a team in the APFA. All right. Well, let's talk about what they did do. Now, they did still have a team during the APFA years, because the APFA teams not only played their schedule against the league, the rest of the league, but they played independent games. Is that where Maslin comes in?
Yeah. You know, again, I've sort of, my story ends there in 1920, so I haven't spent much time following up what happened after the league was founded. So I don't have a good answer for you.
Okay.
On that, but I they did play semi-pro ball and for a number of years under different names in Maslin. There was the Maslin Indians and Maslin Blues and so on. And my friends at the Maslin Museum have an exhibit right now that I saw recently at the weekend you and I met at the Pro Football Researchers Association conference. Mm-hmm. And they've done a nice job of showing images of their teams throughout the years. But I think they sort of wrap up also around 1919, 1920.
Okay. Well, I guess why don't you, maybe you can fill in more of how you did your research for the book. You know, we know basically the premise of the book. We don't want to give away the goodies here. We want to bring you back and talk more about the book closer to release or maybe after release. But maybe you could just tell us what goes into researching. We know you had the family photos, you had the family stories. What all is involved with your course of getting all your research?
It's a good question. And it's painstaking. The detail, fleshing out the details of a lot of it was probably took an average of about 3 different sources per story, you know, per segment, because none of them had a full story or there were conflicting facts. So if you had a Maslin paper, a Canton paper, and a Cleveland paper, you could actually tell the story one game, like one important game. So I literally on my laptop have a folder for every year from about 1892 to 1920. And in each folder, there's a subfolder for images and articles. And I label every single file starting with the date so that they appear in chronological order. And I also put a title with the file that tells me a little quick summary of the story. So I can actually look down the screen and see the story in my head, and that helps me to tell the story. So I pull all those articles from newspaper databases like newspapers.com and newspaperarchives.com. And one rabbit hole after another, one question after, I just go on a hunt. And it I had so many hundreds of files that eventually to be able to write something cohesive, that I figured out that's what I needed to do to compile it and organize it before I could even write something. So that probably took a couple years off my life or right there.
Hopefully you realized that early on. So you were labeling them, you know, if you were organizing. So with me, I would have probably got like halfway through it and had like 1,000 files. Like, you know, maybe I ever go back and relabel these things.
That's kind of how it went. You know, you figure it out as you go along.
Okay. Well, maybe if you could tell us a little bit about where the book, people can pre-order the book, I'm assuming, and maybe, you know, where they can get a copy once it's out.
So I had a pre-sale campaign on Indiegogo, which is kind of like Kickstarter, a crowdfunding site, earlier this year. It was incredibly successful. I far surpassed all forecasts for what, you know, it could do. So, that's expired now, but I think you can still see the info there. But after that, the next step was to create the permanent website for the book, which just came up online about a month ago, gridironlegacy.com. Frank O'Harris, by the way, has also written the foreword for the book, which is really fantastic. He's a very thoughtful, kind fellow and wrote a really beautiful, meaningful foreword. So
that's pretty awesome.
Yeah, I'm thrilled to have him be a part of it. And so on the site, you'll see some quotes from him, people like him and Rocky Blyer and Frenchie Fuqua, his backfield mates for the Steelers, since all part sort of a lot of the Immaculate Reception crowd there since pro football started in Pittsburgh. They kind of talk about what it means to them. And there's a video on the site, sort of me sharing more about the story. And I think it gives people a good flavor for what they'll enjoy in the book.
Wow, that is really awesome. Now, Greg, please promise me as soon as you get the release dates, you know, let us know. We'll post it up on Pigskin Dispatch. We'll talk about it on the podcast, and then we'll get you on here again to talk about the book more in detail. Again, his book is called Gridiron Legacy, Pro Football's Missing Origin Story. Greg Fissery is the author, and gridironlegacy.com is the website where you can follow along and see what the book's all about. And I'm assuming you'll be posting when that becomes available on there also.
Of course, coming soon, as they say.
Appreciate your time, sir, talking about the Massillon Tigers and this great book that's coming out and the story of your grandfather. Sounds very exciting. I can't wait to get a copy and read this when it comes out and to talk to you more here in the near future.
Thanks, Darren. Look forward to it.
Peeking up at the clock, the time's running down. We're going to go into victory formation, take a knee, and let this baby run out. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you back tomorrow for the next podcast. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. PigskinDispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. A special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.